Committee will come to order. Okay, folks, today we got a little late start. We've got a few bills on the agenda here that are going to take up a little bit of time, and then we're going to get the omnibus transportation bill. If anybody's here to testify or listen to testimony on Senate File 3458, it's been taken off of the agenda.
Yeah.
Evidently, the city of Cottage Grove and MnDOT came to an agreement about a sign. And Mr. Rudin, I would hope that that sign doesn't go in the middle of the roundabout. Because if it does, there will be legislation coming back, getting it out of the middle of the roundabout. I don't know what the city's thinking about, but that's not a good place to put a sign. And I would hope that MnDOT, you know, whatever you guys do, don't put it in the middle of the roundabout. Senator John Bauer, you're up first. Senate File 3545.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 3545 is one we talked about the other day. We came to agreements, I think, with everyone now. There was still some people that would just like us never to change anything. So I said, if you can come up with a good reason, we'll change it. I do have one little amendment we need to make on page 2 on our A5. I don't know if everybody has the A5. We're just handing it out. Okay.
I don't think so.
I'll wait till everybody has a copy of that.
Yeah, it's coming around.
Ms. Berezovsky did a wonderful job on this. We had one overstrike that should be removed.
Senator Jungbauer moves the A5 amendments. Mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer, was there something else that you needed to do with this amendment?
On line 2.2, we need to remove the overstrike on self-propelled cranes. And Mr. Chair and members, self-propelled cranes that aren't mounted on a truck chassis, we identify that really what we're dealing with here is units where they have equipment that are mounted on a standard truck chassis. But we do want to keep a self-propelled crane that's built as a self-propelled crane under that special mobile equipment. They operate on the highways under a special permit issued by MnDOT. Mm-hmm. So we just need to remove the overstrike on that. Did you want me to go through each section and tell the members where we
we want to get this amendment in the shape you need to have it in. Is that the only
that
other
that was the only thing we needed.
Okay.
It has to be done a little differently, I think. Well, because, see, that commercial logging, that goes with the log loader, so we have to just add, insert, and self-propelled cranes, I think, after one.
Okay, Senator Jungbauer moves the A5 amendment and instructs council to make self-propelled cranes fit in the language. Senator Jungbauer, it's just a little more technical than removing the strikeout.
Okay.
To make it grammatically correct. Okay. On the A5 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll start with the sections and talk about what we had just changed language on to make all the parties happy. Under subdivision 3B, starting at line 1.5, if you actually go on line 1.7 to the end there, working with MnDOT, the clarification on that standard from the highway, the Insurance Institute, was the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety's findings, in addition to the standards from the Department of Transportation manuals. So, members, what this does is every year when the Insurance Institute comes out with their crash cost indicators on specific intersections and ratings, MnDOT hasn't put that as a factor into their project priorities, and now they will factor that in. Section 2, again, that's the Y plates. I don't think we actually changed anything other than inserting the word rating that was missing before. But members, that really clarifies that a Y plate is for commercial use, and anything that isn't commercial use will run a passenger vehicle plate. Special mobile equipment on line 1.27, section 3. Working with all the parties, as we talked about the other night, we put back in the well drilling and anything that's registered and licensed. So and licensed is new verbiage under Chapter 103I. Kept the road construction, road maintenance, machinery. So members, turning over to page 2 on 2.2, that amendment makes sure that we do cover self-propelled cranes that are built exclusively as a crane and are not a unit mounted on a truck chassis. To make our northern folks happy, we did keep under special mobile equipment, equipment that is used exclusively for commercial logging. So there's a number of tree trimmers and folks in the metropolitan area that are using what would be potentially using commercial logging operations and running without license plates and things around the metropolitan area, kind of subverting that the idea of running something that's truck mounted. But the northern folks that run these commercial logging operations wanted us to keep them under there, so we were happy as long as it was under a commercial enterprise, because they typically do operate under large stands of trees and only minimally. They were telling me 500 to 1,000 miles a year are they actually on the road. Moving down to line 2.19 in under section 5, as we've changed the section for special mobile equipment, and in order to have uniform enforcement and uniform license plating on vehicles or equipment that was mounted on a specific truck chassis, this was an amendment we dealt with the other day, and we did put in, members, the amount of 15% of the Minnesota base rate schedule on this these units that were in special mobile equipment before. And we clarified that the mounted apparatus must perform an off-road or off-pavement function. So again, members, if the mounted apparatus wasn't designed to perform an off-pavement function and really the truck's only going back and forth between job sites and licensed for on the road for that portion, that's why they're only going to pay 15% of what they would pay under the normal GVWR rating.
And Senator Jungbauer, in that regard, I think you've been awfully generous with 15, but I understand that there's still a few people in the industry that wanted more. Is that correct?
There was still a little bit of that was kind of the low end, and I talked to a number of committee members, and they were fine with keeping it on the low end at this point to get everybody up to par, get them licensed and on track. If the committee would want to make that a different number at the committee's pleasure, I'm not opposed to that.
No, Senator Jungbauer, like I said, I thought you were being awful generous.
Well, we want to make sure that everybody's, as we're changing the statute, we get them up to speed. We're not overly burdening businesses as we're implementing some new policy.
Yep.
We already have enough problems with business in the state of Minnesota, so as we change policy and update the statutes, we thought that it wasn't the time to fine-tune that, but any legislature in the future obviously can fine-tune that. Going on to Section 7 on page 3, under line 3.29, again, we're kind of 3.27 to 3.28. We're really talking about and honing in again on the vehicles that were under special mobile equipment and what we're getting to. In 3.29, we again make sure that well boring apparatuses licensed under that 103I are exempt.
That's what I'm wondering.
Senator Jungbauer, under this section, do you want the self-propelled cranes to be put back in?
3.33.
We probably would need that put back in there again. I can't remember, and maybe Senate Counsel can explain why there's a number of different sections of special mobile equipment. Read through them so many times trying to understand the subtleties of the restatements on there that I can't remember the specifics of why, the whys and wheres of each section.
Ms. Bierzowski?
Mr. Chair and members, this Section 7 is in 168A in the statutes, which is the vehicle titling chapter, and then 168 is the previous one in the vehicle registration chapter. They have their own, each chapter has its own sets of definitions.
Okay. Well, then, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berezovsky, I think it would have to be put back in here under, because this exempts it from the titling process. Would that be what we're talking about?
Maybe the department could clarify that. They're
Well, as they can try to figure it out, we can move on and come back to that clarification if you'd like.
Did the department want to make any comments, Mr. Ola?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Larry Ola, Vehicle Services Program Director with Driver and Vehicle Services. The 168, as far as the special mobile equipment with the self-propelled cranes, what we want is the two statutes to be equal, so that if it's special mobile equipment under the 168A, we also want it under the 168. So
okay,
they should be identical.
Then Senator Jungbauer would move to instruct staff to make the grammatical changes to put the self-propelled cranes back in. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Mr. Ola.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
We'll move on to Section 9 at line 4.27. And members, we did strike the old section. I believe it was old Section 9 where we had the 30-mile-an-hour and the escort vehicles. There was a lot of misunderstanding and misinterpretation on that. We couldn't quite clarify how we would implement it today, so we just took that whole section out. So we have a new Section 9. And the new Section 9 is a section on the spotter trucks. We were very specific in spelling out the kind of spotter trucks on line 4.30 that we are dealing with. And members, again, to refresh your memory, this was a clarification based on a federal law. Spotter trucks were not for on-road use, and their manufacturer certificate of origin says that. And now the federal government wants to make sure if they're driving on the road, that they are for on-road use and meet the emissions requirements. So this is an exemption for our businesses that already have spotter trucks in service, and a lot of them being new, we were giving them an exemption till June 30th of 2013 to use those spotter trucks and then change over if they're used on the highway. But on page 5, section 10, we are stating specifically that if they're operated at all on the public streets, they need to meet all the normal requirements of other vehicles in terms of the types of driver's license, the weight restrictions, inspection requirements, and that they're still only allowed within a zone of 2 air miles from the truck freight operation. So members, that makes them under the same rules that any other vehicle on the roads would be. Other than the 2 miles, that limit is because these units are not typically designed for a long distance transfer. And then members, on page 6, section 13, again, it's our complete street study by MnDOT in cooperation with Met Council. And with the date that everyone agreed on line 6.33 of January 15th, 2010.
All right. Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. Is there, Senator Gimsey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer. If on these spotter trucks, if all of the other requirements for the driver's license and the weight and size and load restrictions are complied with for those spotter trucks, why is the 2 mile zone necessary?
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gimsey, the idea is the spotter trucks that are currently in operation do not have that federal designation of for on-road use and don't meet the emissions requirements. So as we're trying to phase them in for those organizations that are going to use a spotter truck on the road, we're specifically spelling out why we do this exemption until 2013, the range that they are allowed to drive since they're not rated for on the road.
Thank you.
Further questions? Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify either in support or opposition to Senator Jungbauer's bill? Mr. Ola, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Larry Ola with Driver and Vehicle Services. The The department really appreciates the effort to make the distinction. I think what really helps us is to know what is special mobile equipment, what is not, from an administrative standpoint. And so we really appreciate the clarity. A couple of items that we do want to express some concern with is in Section 2, we would appreciate some opportunity to look at the possible programming requirements necessary to implement that portion. It is changing some of what from what we currently have with the manufacturer's nominal weight rating to a gross vehicle weight rating. So there is some analysis that we'll have to look at to see whether or not we'll need programming and that type of thing.
Mr. Roll, how long will that take? Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Pat McCormick for the record. I would say that we could probably get back to the committee by Tuesday, I think. We have to have a committee that looks at things and discusses it in terms of stability of the system and then what's required. So we'd know more what the costs would be, but we'd also know the timing of it. That's more of our concern is the timing.
Is the implementation
yes.
the time that, okay.
And Mr. Chair and members, we had discussed that before, but I hadn't heard back from the department. We had discussed about putting a clause in there about making sure that it fits their within the parameters of their existing computer program or if we had to wait as they're changing over. So we're not trying to force the department to do something they're not capable
right.
of doing today. So we discussed it, but we hadn't gotten any feedback.
Ms. McCormick, in regards to Section 2, then, if you could get back with Senator Jungbauer and just let him know what kind of maybe a little bit of language in there to kind of clean that up. So was that it?
Also in Section 5, we're... I think we understand the intent, and I think this may go more from an enforcement effort. If certain vehicles have the ability to register at a lower weight, how are they going to be identified separately from vehicles that are paying a full weight? So for instance, when an individual comes into a deputy registrar office and they say, I need to renew the registration on my 2004 Ford, the deputy registrar doesn't know whether it has special mobile equipment or special equipment attached to it or whether it has a van back where it's carrying regular commerce. And so if there isn't a distinction, they could possibly pay a lower rate, and yet from an enforcement standpoint, it wouldn't be obvious when they're out on the road that they paid a lower rate claiming that they had this equipment attached to the back of them. So it's partially administrative and partially from an enforcement standpoint that we have some questions.
I know, Mr. Chair and members, part of the issue that we're actually solving by clarifying this is a lot of these vehicles under special mobile equipment only have manufacturer's statement of origin, and they do not currently have titles. So in that process, again, the department would probably be able to put something distinct on the title that would indicate that as people come in with their manufacturer's statement of origins and turn that over to a title. I'm not sure how we clarify that otherwise. I'm thinking maybe something in the way that the well people do where they actually carry a placard to deal with public safety of what the statute says and what their unit is. And I believe I have a copy of that in my... Okay. File on the desk.
Well, I believe that Mr. Ola brings up a good point, Senator Jungbauer. Maybe you should talk with the State Patrol and maybe some law enforcement folks and see if you all can't come up with a couple sentences to slide in there.
And Mr. Chair, members, also, if depending on the solution to that, there's a potential of programming also needed for that implementation of that too, so that would be something we'd certainly work
okay.
with Senator Jungbauer with.
Well, I know Senator Jungbauer has worked for a couple of years trying to make some clearer distinctions with the use of these special plates. So, I think now is a pretty good time to kind of get everything lined up, because you know, later on in session here, we're going to make sure that you've got the resources necessary to build a new computer. And it's probably not quite the way the governor had wanted to pay for it, but I think our original idea was better, put it that way. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I don't know what, as we're clarifying it, can we try to move the bill on and clarify it?
Right.
Does it have to go? Where else would it have to go? Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer, why don't we do this? We'll send it to taxes. That way you've made your deadlines, and then if any other committee sees a reason to take a look at it, then you can talk to them. But in the meantime, just make sure you work with Ms. McCormick and her group and maybe somebody from law enforcement. And just so the committee knows, that there is a portion of this bill in the omnibus bill, and it's the portion of the Safe Streets program that Senator Jungbauer has been working on. And as soon as he gets the rest of this cleaned up, we'll put the rest of it in there, too. So,
well, that would be my motion, then, Mr. Chair, to recommend that Senate File 3545, as amended, be recommended to pass and moved on to taxes.
Further discussion? Seeing none on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson. No, these are my bills. You got a chair.
Next is Senator Murphy with Senate File 2991. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 2991 is a bill that talks about some of the design build methods that we've been using to design and build roadway and bridges in the state. First off, Mr. Chairman, we've got a delete everything amendment, the A3 amendment. I'd like to offer that up.
Senator Murphy proposes the A3 delete all amendment. Can you get it passed out?
Mr. Chairman, I move the A3 amendment.
Senator Murphy moves the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the design build process has enabled our state to expedite certain projects all across the state, whether they're bridge projects or road projects. I think a good example of that is down in the Rochester area with the Rock 52 project. There were some hiccups along the way, and nobody's ever going to claim that there weren't. But we were delivered a product clearly a couple of years ahead of what the timeline actually was, and I think that's what the people of the state demand. Did it cost a little bit more? Yeah, but you know what? If you figure in the price of inflation and things like that, I think it's pretty much a wash. But the thing that happened was we took about a 7-year project and turned it into about a 3.5-year project. They're using design build right now on the I-35W bridge. And there were some issues with the way that the lettings actually happened. And I think that that's the direction of the bill. And with me, I have Mr. Werke, who's going to walk through a few of the contentious points of the way the process works now and what we feel is a good rectification of those issues.
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Werke. I'm the Highway Division Director at the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. My apologies to the committee. I was not aware that Senator Murphy wanted me to go through the provisions, but I certainly have some comments I can make.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean
Senator
to
Murphy.
Mr. Werke, you go through the provisions, just kind of what the bones of contention were and how we propose to rectify those.
Mr. Werke.
Committee members, Mr. Chairman, the issues I think that are important in the contracting process, whether it be the low bid model or variations of that to all the way up to design build, I think for contractors are the, number one, that the playing field be level and competitive across all levels so that contractors know what it is they're being asked to propose or bid on and what is expected of them and their competitors so that they can provide the owner, in this case the Department of Transportation, a product in terms of a contract that would provide that owner the best value, the best cost, and those types of things. And as Senator Murphy pointed out, the design-build law has worked well in this state, and I need to stress that. It has worked well. I think the owner has gotten considerable value from that contracting process, and the public has gotten considerable value, both in terms of innovations and in terms of delivering a bridge or a highway project much quicker than the normal low bid process. So what we have here today is not something that we're trying to completely denigrate or dismiss and change that design build process. What we're trying to do in this bill is bring about some elements, some additional elements of certainty, of openness, of fairness in that process so that contractors have a better idea when they're competing as to what is expected of them in that proposal process. Beyond that, if there's any questions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, I think all the members can take a look at the summary of the bill that Ms. Berezovsky and Ms. Boyd put together. Some of these are just a few technical changes, but there are some very substantive changes. One is on in Section 6. In Section 6, the crux of that just says that, you know, the language used to be that you would, that the department could reject a proposal that it deemed non-responsive. And what we're changing here is we're taking that that word deemed out, and we're taking the discretion out and just saying that if it's a non-responsive bid, it's a non-responsive bid. In other words, if you don't meet the criteria, your package gets thrown into the circle file. And, you know, when we first started this process of design build, and it worked its way through the legislature, that's kind of what we thought we were getting, is that if a bid was not responsive, you threw it out. I think that that's a very important change to note, that we're taking the discretion to deem something non-responsive away from the department.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rolstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, I didn't have a chance to really look this over real close yet, but is there any wordage in there about, you know, like there was criteria on the I-35W about public relations? And I wonder if that's the role of somebody building a bridge. And I'm just wondering if that language might be in here or out, or because I thought that was one of the criteria that PR was one of the criteria there.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure Mr. Werke can talk to that point a little clearer, but I think that the criteria that you're talking about was a subset of another major component. And, you know, all those things are weighted and they're scored. What we do here is just to make sure, as I said in Section 6, that, you know, a non-responsive bid is one that goes outside of those parameters for the bid. Now, there were some bids that have been put in, not just for the 35W bridge, but for other design build projects where they're outside of those parameters. Now, a couple things can happen. I mean, you know, you can always call them up and say, hey, is this what you really meant? Because sometimes there's typographical errors. We all know that that happens. Sometimes in these proposals, which are pretty thick documents, things get transposed. Instead of a 3B paragraph, they use 3C, and so there may be some technical things that are wrong. You know, we don't want to take the discretion of the department. We don't want to limit it to where they can't call up and say, is that what you really meant? But when it's clearly that's what they meant and it's outside those guys, we want to make sure that that proposal was dumped. I'll let Mr. Werke talk to the specific instance that you're talking about, though.
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, in Section 5 of the bill, and this may not be specific to your question, but Section 5, subparagraph 2 on page 3, it would be on line 3.6, there's a provision that we've included there that would require the department in those categories where they prescribe points to also further prescribe in the sub-criterion the weight of those sub-criterion as well. For example, if a category had 10 points, and let's say the category was safety, that if there were three sub-criterion listed in the RFP, the request for proposals, in that safety category, or let's say four to make it easier, in those sub-criterion were, you know, things like traffic management or safety professionals on staff, that each of those sub-criterion be given a relative ordering of points within that 10. So they would, if 4 points or four sub-criterion, each of those would be worth 2.5 points. So that the, in this case, the proposer has a better idea of what the owner is looking for, and they're not just shooting a dart at the dartboard for a 10-point score and not knowing exactly what it is that they're trying to do. And we think that in the RFP process, the owner, if they put together a quality RFP, they should be able to identify those things to a fairly good degree of what it is they're looking for.
Senator Cook has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Murphy, I think there might be the answer a little further down, but I'm in Section 6, Subdivision E. It's dealing with the dealing with protests on the design-build process. And among the things that the commissioner can restricts the commissioner in unreasonably restricting the time to protest. And I'm just wondering, as an author, what do you consider a reasonable protest time window? Is that the 7 days that's follows on line 4.27?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mr. Murphy take that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Mr. Werke.
The reason we have that provision in this bill is to provide an opportunity for a proposer to exercise their due process rights if they feel somehow they've been wronged in the process. And I need to help the committee understand there's really two processes here when executing the contract. There's the award of the contract, where the department identifies and the requirements for the contract have been fulfilled by the or have been accepted by the department as being fulfilled by the proposer. And then there's the actual execution, the signing, if you will, of the contract document. And those things on a low bid process would take place at different times. And unfortunately, on the I-35 process, what happened is that the award and execution of the contract occurred simultaneously. And there was not an opportunity for a proposer to exercise to have an opportunity to look at the data and reflect upon that and then to file a protest because those processes occurred simultaneously. So what we're trying to do here in this section is to provide a physical separation of time so that those two things do not occur simultaneously, and that if there is something objectionable, that the aggrieved party can feel like they have an opportunity to respond.
Mr. Chair, so then is that the 7 days, or what are you considering a reasonable time for protest?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cook,
Mr. Werke,
the 7 days is what we've put in there, is what we feel is reasonable.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could jump up to Section 5, I just had a question. I just don't understand, so I'm just curious. Lines 3.24 and 3.25, a statement that past performance, experience, or other criteria used in the RFP evaluation process does not include the exercise or assertion of a person's legal rights. Just curious to know what we're trying to accomplish there.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Werke has a better answer than I do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, what we're getting at, I believe there, the sentence, the section reads, a statement that past performance, experience, or other criterion used in the RFP evaluation process does not include the exercise or assertion of a person's legal rights. I think, if you give me 1 second so I can confer here.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble. What that means is what we're trying to do here is that if a proposer in this case has ever exercised legal rights, their legal rights in the past to sue, that they are not penalized for so doing in the RFP process, that it's not held against them, if you will.
Oh,
apologize
okay.
for that.
I see. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there anything, like I think if you're building a road, you're building a road, but on the bridge, we saw two different kind of designs, you know, primarily you want like three bids on a steel and one on a concrete. And is there going to be a requirement, or is it going to remain open that when somebody does a proposal, it's, you know, whatever they think they can build at whatever price most effectively? Or should MnDOT have said that we're looking at a concrete bridge on that one? Or I'm just curious about that.
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I'm hesitant to speculate and speak for the department. I won't speak for the department on that. But our position would have been in that situation that the RFP should have spoken clearly about what elements the department was looking for in the proposal. You can argue from the other side that being less specific breeds more innovation or breeds more, innovative ideas. But from a proposer's perspective, the more the owner can speak to what it is they're looking for, the easier it is and the more efficient it is for the proposer to give a quality proposal. And one of the things I think the committee should understand that's important in this is that in the data in the projects that have been processed under the design build model in the past, I think bears this out to a large degree, is that the more innovation that a proposer can put together and the higher the score that they can achieve in terms of the quality of their proposal often leads to the lowest price. And in some respects, that's a little counterintuitive when you think about it, but from a design in a project development standpoint, those innovations help the contractor identify ways to stage the project more efficiently or to use materials that may be more efficient, those types of things that can lead to a lower cost. So our point, in which I think a long answer to your question, was that in that situation we would have felt the owner should have prescribed the type of structure they were looking for in the RFP.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rothstein.
Is there anything in here addressing that then, or do you think it needs to be addressed at some point, or are you comfortable with it being more wide open like you said it kind of generates innovation?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rothstein, in this proposal, Senator Murphy's proposal here, there is nothing I think that specifically addresses that. I think it would be hard to put that requirement into statute for the owner to spell those things out to that degree. I think with the changes that we have reflected in this legislation, we feel as contractors that it brings a confidence level back to the process that we would feel comfortable participating in again to the fullest extent, and that we would be treated in a reasonable manner by the owner.
Senator Dibble and Senator Saltzman. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is along those same lines. Looking at the top of page 4, which says that for those projects in excess of $10 million, the responsible design builder is the lowest score that does not exceed 110% of the lowest price that is submitted by a responsible design builder. Just wondering if we could visit for a minute on that 100. I know exactly what you're trying to accomplish and know where that comes from. Just wondering if the 110% is the magic sweet spot, or just how you arrived at that.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, if you look at the project, and this is a value in excess of $10 million, and then start figuring in 10% on that, the numbers can get quite large. So, basically what we're trying to do here is to, narrow that band a little bit so that, you don't have bids coming in at 250 and then bids coming in at 200. Those are out of the band. And I believe that's where we were trying to go with that, so that we don't get You know, and for the most part, I think and truly believe that the design build bidding process normally comes off without a hitch. But, you know, back to I-35, when you have a process by which, you know, and this is, don't get me wrong, this is a great bridge that's being built. I think the quality is, you know, people are going to be very happy with this bridge. But the bottom line is that we ended up getting the highest bid that took the longest time. And, you know, if we're going to use the design-build process, as I said in my opening statements, they have advanced projects to where, you know, that time makeup pays for a little bit of the additional cost. In this project, I don't know if we could clearly and, you know, accurately say that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Saltzman.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think that what Senator Saltzman referred to was, again, with the cost of the I-35, was that had all the contractors had the similar vision of what the of what they wanted, that if they had all competed for the same type of bridge, perhaps it would have been a more competitive bid process. And that's, I think, where the question is in terms of fairness, that, you know, how do you describe it? Because the public, they can't figure this out. And that what seemed to be the intent of what the owners were looking for was perhaps different. And that's what I think the public doesn't understand is, why did you take the bridge that had the highest cost? And had it seemed the contractors were a little confused, too, as to what were the owners looking for when they, you know, put this bid out. So, and I'm not sure how to fix that in here, but that's the selection process.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, yeah, and as Mr. Werke said earlier, you know, we're trying to kind of tighten this up a little bit so that all the players involved kind of know the rules of the game and have a good understanding that they have to go to first base and then second and then third and then home. Not that people were confused about going to first and then through right field and maybe the third base coach's box and then to second. But there were some things that were left out there, and obviously the public picked up on them. I mean, there was a substantial amount of head shaking going around. I'd use stronger language, but there were a lot of people who were wondering, you know, exactly what we were getting for what turns out to be about $70 million more. And, you know, those questions are tough to answer. Does this go 100% of the way of rectifying that? No, because as Mr. Werke said, we need to allow people back here like Mr. Heptis, who has worked on this for several years, we need to allow them to use their creative intellect to come up with designs and plans that are the best for the state. Now, you know, saying that, was did we get the best for the state with a 35W bridge that is being built now? I think that we're getting one heck of a good piece of equipment, period. And does it mean that any of the other bids that were out there were any less capable of winning that one heck of a, you know, piece of equipment status? No, I think they all were probably in that category. But, you know, once again, we can't limit the creativity of the people in our department or the people who are bidding on the contract. I think this is actually, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I know that Ms. Parker is going to get up and talk about some of the hot button issues that they have with this, but I would say that this is a modest proposal compared to what it could be.
Senator Dibble.
I just
I'm sorry, Senator Dahl.
Thank you. I just wanted to bounce off what Senator Salzman was saying, is that if it is one heck of a bridge, I'm thinking most of the folks that I've heard from that are concerned is that $70 million better of a heck of a bridge versus the other ones is the big concern, that there was such a substantial difference between the other three bids out there that was the concern.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, it was 57 on the bid, Mr. Chairman, and if you add in the bonus, and I'm pretty sure that Flatiron's going to come in well ahead of schedule, and you add in the 24 on the bonus, and you get 84.
Or
81, something like that. Oh, yeah, 81, I'm sorry. My math is worse than his handwriting skills, so... Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl and Senator Salzman, you're exactly right. We're just trying to narrow that band down a little bit so that all the bids are kind of come in, you know, relatively in the close proximity of each other. But not limiting the type of design that comes in. Construction projects are expensive. We all know that. And if we can, you know, save a little bit of money here and there, that means that there's probably a road going to get built out in your neck of the woods that's not going to get built today. But if we don't have a real close focus on the pocketbook, there could be some money going out the door that doesn't need to be. And I think with the legislative auditor's report coming in and showing that there are quite a few cost overruns on primarily these contracted jobs, that draws pause, and we need to, put things in place to kind of tighten that down a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you. And Senator, I'm wondering if we can also look at these smaller projects, like the stairs that get built that are $1,300 a step. There's a way to address those type of things as well.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Well, so, it's hard to dictate common sense, but and I'm not going to say that was a huge mistake on MnDOT's part, but hindsight, I think we probably could have done things better, and I think they would agree to that too.
Now, Senator Murphy, I see that your amendment removes the 20% variation that can happen in the technical score. What's the background of that? I guess maybe what I need to do is I need to say the things that are on my mind now, too. I've been very critical of this design-build process from the very start. And in the design-build process, we have the ability to change the daily rate. But and some of you know that I've done some sensitivity analysis on this because I've done a lot of design-build work myself in my prior career and accepted and rejected a lot of bids myself and have done a lot of vendor qualifications, everything that's in all of this law, but of course in private industry you don't have to write it into law, you get to have a lot more flexibility. But when I look at something like this that is in law and then I look at what happened, and you're absolutely right, we're going to get a fantastic bridge here. I don't know that we wouldn't have gotten a fantastic bridge with any of the other bidders. But what we did do is we justified it with a process. And that process had, for instance, the daily rate of $200,000 a day that was figured in, calculated into the coming up with the final score on which the selection of vendor was based. And that that daily rate was $200,000. But if you changed it to a dollar a day, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. If you'd have raised it to $1 million a day, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. If the follow-up bidder would have bid $18 million less than the winning bidder, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. If the winning bidder would have bid $26 million more, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. But if you would have changed the technical score by 5.4 points, The bridge that we would have been building today would have been $57 million lower cost at least, because there is the incentives, and it would have been 70 days faster. So to my way of thinking, that 5.4 points made an immense difference in the decision-making on this bid award. And to me, this is far too great to let go for many more times. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I think is we should be working on this a lot more.
Senator Carlson, I appreciate your comments. And you've had a lot of experience in this area, and I don't know too many people on the committee that have that type of experience. But once again, I think that if we craft a bill too tight, then we may be cutting off opportunity that our state needs to have. I understand what you're saying, that 5 points on a technical score can push the price around in a band of about $50 million. But I think that if with some of the other language that's built in here, I think it's going to keep that, it's going to lower that band of bids. Because somebody could score exceptionally high on their technical end and may come in on a few other ends where they're lower, and then they wouldn't get the bid. They may come in lower on technical, may have a higher score in other areas, and would get the bid. And, that's kind of the trade-off that contractors have. They look at a project, and they look at how it's going to be weighted under this system. They have a good idea of what, and you know this, of what product they have to bring forward so that they get good scores across the board and have a good chance of winning the award. I think that if we start going in and trying to cap all of those scores or set some sort of very stringent guideline, that, once again, we may miss a product that we really want here in the state. I'm interested in hearing what Ms. Parker has to say and for MnDOT. So.
Okay. Any other questions for the testifier, for the senator?
Ms. Parker. Stay up here.
Yeah, okay.
Ms. Parker.
Ms. Parker, we'd like to hear from the department.
This is a score sheet of all the prior design build projects. It basically shows that most all of them get the highest technical price on
Ms. Parker.
This bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I do have a few comments I want to make. First of all, I want to tell you that the department values all of its contractors. There's been a lot of discussion about whether the department has treated people properly as a result of the 35W bridge contract. The dispute we're in with the contractors today does not change our estimation of the very good work done by many of these contractors over many years. The department has nearly 200 construction projects a year, and I don't think you hear complaints about many of them very often. If you do, it's a very small percentage of them. So I would like to remind you that the department has a very long record of making excellent engineering decisions and having very good working relationships with contractors. The situation with the 35W bridge is an extraordinary situation. It is one that occurs very rarely. Nothing like this has ever happened in the state before, and we hope and pray it never will again. And I think it is a big mistake to try to write one piece of legislation to address what everyone must admit is surely the most extraordinary of situations. It's always a mistake to try to write law that addresses a major exception rather than to address a rule that applies to many situations well. The second thing I would like to emphasize about this is that the department is in litigation right now, and I believe it is not even proper for this bill to be before the committee. There are contractors who have sued the department. And there is some dispute over who are actually the plaintiffs in the litigation. But the very issues that were discussed here this morning and that are raised in this bill are being litigated before a court. The plaintiffs sought a temporary restraining order against the department, which the judge denied. And part of the reason he denied it was because there was not a likelihood that the plaintiffs would prevail in their lawsuit. That lawsuit is scheduled for trial in September, and it seems to me premature for the legislature to be changing the law before the judge has even had an opportunity to hear all the arguments about the issues that are in this bill and in the lawsuit and to rule on them. The other thing that is very difficult is that the department deliberately chose the bidder, the proposer that it chose, for very good reasons. It felt it offered the best value to the citizens and to the state, both in terms of the actual construction of the bridge and in the management of the contract. Some questions have been raised about public relations, and I would like to remind you that we are constantly urged to have more communication with people. We go through municipal consent processes, we go through scoping processes, we go through 18 months or more of processes with construction projects that were compressed into a period of maybe a month in this case because of the need to put the bridge back in place in a hurry. And as a result, a lot of that work of dealing with the citizens, with the city of Minneapolis, was put on the shoulders of the contractor and the MnDOT people working with the contractor on this project. And so it was absolutely essential that there be a public relations component to this contract. And if you want to compare it with something, you can compare it with the Crosstown, which has a great deal of public relations around it also, which includes things like daily notifications of whether there's going to be pile driving, nighttime work, noise, dust, detours, all of these other things that greatly concern the citizens who are closest to these projects. I think it's very important to keep in mind the nature of a best value process. The design-build process is a best value process. It is not a low bid process, and it never was intended to be a low bid process. In a low bid process, the department writes complete specifications down to literally every nut and bolt. And we prescribe exactly what kind shall be used, what size, where it shall be placed, how many there shall be. And that goes through everything, the grading, the earthwork, all the materials put in place, and the design. In best value, we do none of that. We are looking for people to give us ideas. We're paying for ideas, for creativity, for innovation. And the idea is that in return for possibly extra cost, you get something built much faster, and you may get ideas you never would have thought of yourself, and they might have a much longer value to the state. To the extent that you restrict the design-build statute by putting in cost limitations, you are severely restricting the ability of bidders to be creative and the ability of the state to get what is truly a best value. And I would like to remind you that last year the legislature passed best value legislation that applied to every agency in the state. And if you looked at that legislation, you would see that it has probably less than 25% of the specificity that exists in MnDOT's design-build law. You passed a law authorizing every other agency to write contracts that have none of the things that are proposed here for MnDOT today, and it seems to me quite a disparity in expectations in agency contracting. We have looked at this bill and have been in extensive discussions with representatives of AGC and in particular with Representative Kalin in the House, who has had a number of meetings with us. And I would just like to tell you that we very much appreciate Representative Kalin's patience with our concerns about this bill and his willingness to sit with us and AGC representatives while we talked about this. There are some things that are in this bill that we would agree to if they were in a different bill that didn't affect the things that we feel are most fundamental to the design-build process. And I will tell you what those items are. Those items include waiting 7 days between the award and the execution of the contract so that people have an opportunity to look at how the proposals were scored and who the proposer is. Right now we wait 7 to 10, sometimes more days, for all of our low bid contracts between award and execution. So we are okay with the language that is in the bill with respect to that. We are also comfortable agreeing that there would be no conditions on the payment of the stipend. That is in this bill, too. The stipend, the purpose of the stipend is to compensate the proposing teams for some small percentage of the work that they do, which benefits the state. And we are also comfortable with the language that says that the assertion of a person's legal rights will have no effect on their evaluation. In fact, that language is already in the existing design build law today. That language is law now. The department has agreed with AGC that it would be willing to have one technical review committee member at the senior administrative engineer level or higher. We had a discussion about that just the other day. And we have also agreed that we are comfortable with the language that states that the state should put no unreasonable restrictions on the right to protest or seek judicial review or other review. All of those are procedural due process fairness items, and they are, we think, completely appropriate and apart from some of the things that we find objectionable to the bill. With respect to the things that we cannot agree to in this bill, we cannot agree to record every meeting that occurs. The only reason for recording a meeting is if someone is anticipation of a lawsuit later. And I think perhaps people don't realize how many meetings and how many conversations we have with proposers at the request of the proposer. The idea of recording everything is somewhat threatening and raises questions, I think, about what can be discussed. The fact that it would all be, it would have to be withheld probably for proposers to feel comfortable about it with respect to availability by other competing proposers. The other thing, one other thing that really concerns us about this bill, and this is one of the major issues in the lawsuit that is now before the court, is the removal of any discretion from the determination of responsiveness. If you removed the complete discretion from responsiveness, we would probably never qualify a single proposer, not one single proposer. We would be back to using the low bid process. It is absolutely impossible to remove discretion from a best value procurement. Best value, by its very nature, is subjective. Now, subjective can be on a continuum, and I guess the question is where along the continuum the subjectivity falls. But you cannot have a best value determination without some discretion in determining what's responsive. There has to be some point where there's a determination that something is at least substantially responsive. And most of all, we object to changing the scoring, which we believe basically returns this process to a low bid process and simply makes it not worth the amount of effort that goes into the process for the department or for the proposers. I would like to remind you again that this situation was an extraordinary situation. We will never again have a process where the time is so compressed, the stakes are so high, and we have so many people from different jurisdictions, state, federal, and local, all watching us closely and demanding that we do something, many of them competing things, with respect to the process of getting the bridge rebuilt. It's a big mistake to try to write a law that addresses what is an extraordinary situation, and you are putting at risk the best value process in construction in MnDOT. I think that the department has used the design-build process very sparingly since 2001 when it got that authority. We've had, I think, about 6 contracts over that period of time. And the process is heavily regulated by the legislature now. Whenever we decide to use the process, we must tell the legislature in advance that we have selected the design-build process for this particular construction job. No other agency has that kind of requirement. You're also required to submit an annual report about the progress of all the design-build projects we have underway. No other agency has that kind of requirement. I think that it's an overreaction at this point to try to write legislation while we are in litigation before the bridge is completed and with a somewhat limited understanding of what actually took place in the technical evaluation process. Had we accepted any of the other proposals, we would likely have written change orders to those proposals shortly after the contract was signed, because we would not have built those bridges as designed because they did not accommodate future geometric needs in the area. That would have significantly raised the cost of any of those contracts. So I think that there are many things to consider in this, and I realize that the public talks about this a great deal. The public responds to things that they can understand from their own experience in life, which is how all of us, I think, view life. But when we're dealing with our own experiences in life, they don't always fully inform us about things that might be outside our scope of experience, which I think might be the case with this contract in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, and I understand the reasons behind some of Ms. Parker's statements. The department is in litigation. They feel that this may in some way influence some outcome in court, which I don't believe to be true at all. There are no preconceived reasons why this is here other than we got the bridge that took the longest time and cost the most money, and the public wanted answers. Now, Ms. Parker makes a lot of different statements, but one that I want you to pay particularly close attention to is the one where she said that we would have had to go back and maybe reconfigure some of the prices on the other bids if we would have chosen one of those. And the reason why is because, and I believe that we have procedures in law that says that when people are contracting or bidding on proposals that you can't bid outside of the right-of-way. You can't submit proposals that are outside of the right-of-way. Well, the Flatiron bid was outside of the right-of-way. The other bids were not. And so there could have been an increase of costs knowing that there were things that had to happen outside of the right-of-way, approaches, things like that. I can let Mr. Werke explain some of that. But, you know, these are the arguments in a court of law. We're here to try to tighten up the process a little bit. And Ms. Parker talks about the limitations and you know, we won't get best value. We'll still get best value with this. And we're not tightening up those limitations so much that we're gonna hamstring the creativity of a lot of the bids that come in. It's just, I think that Ms. Parker has overstated their case. I was one of the initial folks that helped pass the original design build law, and I believe that this is a good law, and we need to keep using this tool. It's a great tool. I think I said that earlier. But and Ms. Parker's right. This was a very unusual event that this was used on. But but I've heard other complaints on other design builds. So it's not just that they were all about the I-35W bridge process. No, there's other ones. Were they as heated or as many? No, absolutely not. The ones that came in that were heated and the most amount was with the 35W bridge process. But folks, we're just not completely throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. All we're doing is trying to tighten up a few things so that we can kind of bring a little bit of, because I think, Ms. Parker, the public was, they weren't real happy that we took the high bid in the longest time, and they wanted to know why. And nobody has explained that to them thoroughly yet today.
Senator Murphy.
And I think that Mr. Werke had a couple of comments to make as well.
Okay. Senator Murphy, I guess I just wanted to reinforce what you were saying there, that we did have 70 days extra and $57 million more to be able to make these elevation adjustments had we needed to. So there was money there. There is money that we're going to be putting into that bridge, and that could have been done if there were minor adjustments that needed to be made. So, Mr. Werke.
And Mr. Chairman, I want to make one more point, because we need to get going here, okay, because we've got a lot of other stuff to take care of, and we have to be out of here, Ms. Russell, 11:45, 12. Okay, and we've got a lot of stuff to do. But in regards to the very first section of the bill, this is all about the Sunshine Law. This is all about having good public documents and good pub. I mean, this is what we do. That's why we're having the meeting here today. Does it withhold comments? Well, if they're snide comments, yeah, if the tape's running, somebody's not going to make those comments. But if the comments that are made, you know, all you have to do is be truthful and exact with the information. I don't know why that would disturb anyone from making their thoughts known in a professional basis. It should not do that.
Mr. Werke, did you want to comment? We have some questions.
Just one or two quick points, and I want to stress what Senator Murphy said. The provisions that we've included in here, in particular the portion, Section 1, dealing with recording, speaks exactly to that point of fairness and of being able to know from a proposer's standpoint that materially significant things as they relate to the project and as questions are being and answers are being provided in one-on-one meetings, private meetings, that the same questions are asked and answered in the same way to all parties so that all parties know that they are proposing on precisely the same thing so that we don't end up in situations where there is a dispute of what is being told to one party was not the same as the other. And one other point I just wanted to bring as a consequence of illustration. When the statement was made about the public relations component, in this 35W procurement project, and I may be off by an order of magnitude, but each point for each team was valued at around $3.5 million per point on a 100-point scale. And I believe the amount of points ascribed to public relations was about 15 points. And it may be an overgenerous simplification, but, you know, in my math, that's about $45 million. As a counterpoint to illustrate, the Crosstown Commons project, I believe, has a budget for public relations in the neighborhood of $800,000.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to say very, very quickly, I support this bill, particularly the sunshine disclosure, fair treatment, you know, all that stuff. I think these are really good initiatives and reforms. Certainly, some of our local contractors in the local contracting community felt the worst about some of those aspects of this most recent experience. I don't know, Senator Murphy, if we've quite gotten there on the 110% piece, and that's the only place where I have a question mark and would want to have some more discussion.
Yeah.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, knowing that time is tight here and
we have one more question from Senator Day.
And that this bill is, you know, there might be a couple things that we can work with Ms. Parker here and kind of take care of a few of the issues. I would move to lay Senate File 2991 on the table.
Senator Murphy moves to lay Senate File 2991 on the table. We have a question from Senator Dave.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I was kind of interested in is if Ms. Parker could explain the people that did the scoring on this. How many people did the final scoring sitting in a room comparing all the different projects? I personally believe we wouldn't even be here today talking about this if the project would have went to one of the local people. The only reason we're here, this is kind of like, to me, the sour grapes bill, because they didn't win the bid. And if they had won the bid, you can be assured that Mr. Werke would be with whoever won the bid and having a coffee this morning with a nice blueberry muffin and enjoying life. But because somebody else won the bid, even though, and I guess I would like to find out if the bid was done wrong. Then I have a little bit of a problem. If the bid was done right and somebody said, geez, you know what? That bridge sitting right next to that one is concrete. That's been there for 110 years. The one that went down is steel. You know, maybe we should do a concrete bridge. I'm interested in what Minnesotans, what do our people in the state think? What kind of a bang for the buck do we get? Do we get a deal where a guy says 110%? We got this whole thing in litigation now.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
And we look through here and he says 110%, so we're now going to do it so that if somebody has a low bid and we're going to try and match you up and say, oh, you can't get the bid. How many of you people have done projects and went out to get bids 3-4 times? I built homes once in my life. It's not unusual to get bids that are quite a bit different, and if they bid what you want done, you go with the low bid. You don't say, well, I'm going to bring it back in because I'm just not so sure you can do this. And then we're in litigation, and it's another case of in Minnesota, we are really getting to a point where the transportation committees in the House and the Senate are getting very adversarial with the Department of Transportation that's trying to build the roads. And I see it every cotton picking day, and I'm telling you, I somewhere along here, we got to kind of decide we got to work with MnDOT, and if we can improve them, fine. But we don't improve them by just banging away because somebody lost a bid.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I think that some of your remarks are really close to crossing the line. First,
Mr. Chairman,
flat
why?
Iron. Mr. Chairman,
close
Mr.
To
Chairman,
what?
Senator Day, first of all, Flatiron is a member of AGC, part of the group that Mr. Werke represents. The other thing is,
Mr. Chairman,
the people,
you think if Ames Construction would have got this project, we'd be here today with this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Senator Day, I think that your constituents were just as irate as everyone else. Excuse me, we need to stop those folks. They can't be back there. Thank you. We would be here today if they would have won the bid and had one that was, 80-some million dollars over the lower bid and took the longest time, Senator Day. We all would have been here, and I think that you would have been hollering just as loud as anybody else, all right? And we know that, well, never mind, I'm not going to go there. First, AGC, along with a lot of other folks, were the technical people that scored that proposal, Senator Day. There is a lot of good technical people that work on those committees, and we're not trying to impugn their character at all with this, Senator Day. I think that you've read way too much into it. And, Mr. Chairman, you can ask Ms. Parker that we have tried to work with MnDOT on a lot of different issues, some more controversial than others. Are we always successful? No. It's because we have differences of opinion. People are human, Senator Day. And I think that when you get the high bid that takes the longest time, everybody in the state should pay attention. Now, Mr. Chairman, I made a motion to lay this bill on the table. I'll renew that motion.
Senator Murphy moves to lay Senate File 2991 on the table. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. And the motion is adopted.
It's as amended, correct?
That was as amended, sir.
Yes.
Next is Senator Murphy, Senate File 2987.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2987, I do have a delete all amendment, and I don't know if that's been, has it been passed out?
No, it has not
okay.
been passed out.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 2987 is simply a bill which tries to determine what some of the standards are for products and materials that are used, specifically treated wood, when we build sound barriers and things like that. And we do have a member of the industry that's here that can speak as to the need for this. But there's been, we've worked with MnDOT, Senator Day's gone. At first, this bill gave MnDOT a lot. Oh, he's still here. Senator Day, at first, this bill gave MnDOT serious heartburn. And I think today we've worked out a little bit of it. I think that there's still some question, and we're still working on this, Senator Day. And hopefully we come to a resolution that everybody can put their arms around.
Senator Murphy moves the A2 amendment to Senate File 2987. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Senator Murphy, your testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. My name is David Clemens. I live in Eagan. I am the Highway Product Sales Manager for Wheeler Lumber. We have offices in Bloomington and manufacturing facilities in Shakopee. We've maintained a presence in Minnesota since the 1930s, primarily supplying treated wood products into the highway market. We've enjoyed a long relationship with MnDOT, working with them to keep their standards up to date as the industry changes in terms of what is available for treated wood. Historically, MnDOT has required that the treated wood they use in their projects meet national standards as established by the American Wood Protection Association. In 2003, they began adding special provisions to specific projects to allow materials that do not have a national standard as established by the American Wood Protection Association. Since then, Wheeler and our industry organization, the Treated Wood Council, has had ongoing discussions with MnDOT as to why they have changed from using a national standard in the acceptance of materials. We are most concerned about the evaluation of efficacy. Essentially, that determines the suitability of a product from a durability standpoint, that it's going to function in the manner that is expected. Evaluating efficacy can be a fairly arduous task, and that is what the American Wood Protection Association does. By specifying wood that does not have an AWPA standard brings into question whether or not it has been evaluated for efficacy. We are asking that MnDOT demonstrate how they are reviewing preservatives that do not have an AWPA standard to show that they have evaluated its efficacy so that it will function in the manner as expected. Some of these projects can deal with not only premature replacement, which would be an economic concern, but also public safety if the stuff does not perform as expected. Also, the industry is continuing to evolve. If you've walked into any home supply store and actually looked at the treated wood that you're buying, it tends to change every 18 months. So the concern is, moving forward, if the MnDOT is going to be reviewing treated wood and they are going to consider products that have not been adopted by AWPA, what are they doing to determine that the material will have the appropriate efficacy for the use that they're going to put it into?
Mr. Wheeler, could you give us just a quick rundown on what types of products and how they're used?
The product that's come into question is widely used for the noise barriers. If you look at the Crosstown Project, 494, the extension of 212, the Unweave the Weave, 694 35E project, all of those noise barriers have been built with a product that does not have an AWPA standard. Other treated wood products that the DOT would have reason to use would include some guardrail posts, The other extension of this is that projects that MnDOT is associated with, or if they are looked to as an authority, and I'll bring up the examples, the city of Duluth had a pedestrian bridge built where the bridge required timber decking, and the specification called for this particular product that has no standard for efficacy, and that bridge is being built with that decking for that bridge. Now, is that a MnDOT-owned bridge? No, but they were responsible for allocating the money, and therefore they set the standard for what was built. So we're questioning the use of that material for a structural application as decking on a pedestrian bridge. So it has to do specifically with products they're putting into their own projects, as well as when they are looked on as an authority or have spec writing authority on projects that are locally owned, county and city.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Murphy.
That's this one.
Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank Mr. Clemens for being here today to provide some of the background as to why this bill is here. And he also mentioned some sound barriers that we have that are being built in the metropolitan area here and that they don't meet some of these standards. That's not to say that there was probably not good justification as to why MnDOT kind of deviated from what those national standards are. What we're asking to do here is for MnDOT to kind of go back and reassess what the national standards are, kind of look at their policies in regards to treated wood and treated wood only. And then to, you know, work with some of the vendors and manufacturers and, you know, those folks of interest to maybe come up with a better guideline of materials to be used. Now, as you can see that this bill has went through a couple gyrations, you know, we're on the A2 amendment. We had the A1 amendment. We had the original bill. Mr. Chairman, I want to make three oral amendments to this bill, and then Ms. Parker has told me that they're perfectly comfortable with it, and I think that we still have the crux of the bill going forward. First, I want to change the date. I'll wait for Ms. Spierzowski here. On the A2 amendment, we want to change that date to February 1 of 2009. We want to strike clause 3 on line 1.13. And then on line 1.17, strike and comment on the report.
Ms. Berezovsky can read back the amendments, the verbal amendment.
We should keep on the report.
Line 1.5, delete December 1, 2008, and insert February 1, 2009. On 1.12, at the end of the line, insert and delete 1.13, 1.14, delete 4 and insert 3, and 1.17, delete and comment on.
Thank you, Ms. Berezovsky. Mr. Chairman, the reason why we're doing that is that the department feels that they need a little more time to bring this report back to the chairs and the ranking minority members. And that December date, well, we all know that they're going to be busy doing a lot of different things. We want to make sure they have enough time to do a good job with this report. The reason why we take Clause 3 out is because it's not specific to wood products, and so Ms. Parker and the group, they'd be going out and checking their steel and their concrete and looking at every procedure that under the sun for any product. And then and taking the comment on the report out, normally vendors and manufacturers and those folks are They don't provide comment on the report, just on input in establishing the report. And that's the reason why we've made the changes. Ms. Parker did want to say something in regard to the changes.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, members excuse me, of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I just wanted to make a short statement about this. We have agreed to work with the wood treaters and are comfortable with the bill as it is now amended by Senator Murphy. I just want to tell the department, or I mean tell the committee, just a couple things about this issue. Number one is that the issue is really not about the efficacy of the product. In other words, whether the product protects the wood. The issue is really about the environmental effects of certain products that we use. We were using something called CCA, copper chromated arsenate, I believe, and it was discovered that it leached into soil, and then we had to find another product to use because we are liable under state law for the environmental consequences of materials that we use. And there's also an executive order that requires us to evaluate the environmental effect of every product that we use. And so that has been almost the guiding principle in determining what are the appropriate kinds of chemicals to use in these. And we can, when we get into this study, we'll talk about how we do our studies and all those things. The other thing I wanted to tell you was that actually an outside third party, neutral party, has looked at the process that the department uses. The treated wood industry was unhappy with our decision and filed a petition with the commissioner. That petition was heard by an administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings last year, and that administrative law judge determined that the department had statutory authority to use the process that it was using and had a duty to comply with environmental statutes requiring us to evaluate the environmental effects of materials that we used, and said that our process was consistent with the statutory mandate that the department weigh environmental considerations, and also said that it provides a process and guidelines to make the review consistent and orderly. And so it's not just our opinion that it's the right process. It has been reviewed by a neutral party, but we will be happy to sit down again and do a study and take input on that. And that's all I have to say about it.
Thank you, Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion on the A2 amendment. The oral amendment, I should say.
Senator Murphy moves to – we have not adopted A2 yet. No. Senator Murphy moves to moves the A2 amendment as amended. Mm-hmm. Any further discussion on the A2 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
Mr. Chair, then I would move that Cinefile 2987 be recommended to pass and placed in the omnibus transportation bill.
Senator Murphy moves Cinefile 2987 be recommended to pass and be held for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Senator Murphy. Yeah. Motion is adopted. Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, now we have the omnibus transportation policy bill in front of us. Members, you can read through the bill. I've got a little handout here, too, which talks about which bills are in there. Quickly, I'll go through that instead of going through the bill. What you have here that has the Senate file numbers on it, those are the bills as amended that are in the policy bill. There is one thing that that I'm going to draw your attention to, and that's Article 2 when we get there. But for right now, I'm going to breeze through this. We've heard all these bills. This piece of paper that I'm running down is not in line with the way the bill's put together. But Ms. Bierzowski worked last night until about 3 in the morning, and want her to work around the clock, and she would have had to have a bill summary that matched up with the bill.
but I've got the summary right here. So here's what's in the bill. First off, Senate File 16, that's the bill that is the primary violation for the seatbelt. That's the same as we had passed it last year. It's a $25 fine, and the surcharge is reduced to $25. There's also the Carlson bill for the passenger restraint systems for kids. Senator Wergen's bill is here on the FFA medical certificate for using the federal aviation medical certificate for the
Senator
school
Murphy,
bus driver
if you could
exam.
Kind of go a little bit slowly because no one in the audience has the bill yet, evidently.
Okay, that means I need to pick up the pace.
okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, so I'll tell you what. I'm just going to hit the controversial items because the rest of it is pretty much milquetoast. Senate File 1605, this was a Senator Neville bill, and it imposes a curfew and passenger restrictions on provisional license holders. This is what we call the graduated driver's license. That is in. There is also Senator Salzman's bill that requires a commissioner of the Department of Transportation to appoint a deputy commissioner who's also the chief engineer, and they have to be a professional licensed engineer. There's a couple other bills in here. One is the LATS bill, which halts the cumulative suspensions, one suspension on top of the other. I think that the committee felt that that was a pretty good idea, so we put that in there. There's also a DAL provision in here, which is the temporary permit while awaiting the delivery of license plates. There was a little bit of controversy behind that, but so what? One that is very controversial is the Senate file that this bill is on. Senator Dibble and I swapped authorship on his bill so that we could pile the omnibus bill on top of that. The underlying bill is the retrieval of the impounded vehicle contents, and we're going to have a discussion on that because there are people here that represent the folks that have their vehicles impounded, and there's also towers that are here. And then Senator Olsen has a bill in here that talks about creating the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. This is a state patrol function. We're waiting for Senator Olsen's bill to clear a couple committees because there was a fiscal implication in that bill as well. It's not that it's controversial. It's just that there's money attached to it, and we're going to wait and see what happens there. And then there's also we have a portion of Senator Jungbauer's bill in here, which is the complete streets policy. I don't think that that's controversial, but I just mention it because we took that last section of your bill from what we heard earlier today, and we put it in here. And I think now that you're getting your other bill cleaned up, we'll be able to put the rest of that, the guts of that, in this once we get to the Senate floor. So, folks, there's bills that are in this bill that have not cleared some of their other committees. But what we're going to do is we're going to take this omnibus bill and we're going to put it on the Senate floor. And once all the bills clear other committees, like Senator Jungbauer's bill, getting the controversy worked out, then we'll move forward on the Senate floor, but not until that happens. So, members, that's basically the bill, and there's one section that I want to mention, and that is Article 2 of the bill. And that starts on page 65. Now, folks, I'm not trying to do things in the dark of night. We do things in our committee, out in public, on record. When we pass the
omnibus funding bill earlier in the year and were successful in overriding the governor's veto. There was a portion of the bill that our metropolitan counties had checked off on that created a little bit of extra money because they were losing the wheelage portion of the bill, and they also lost the other quarter cent that was supposed to be used to help fund some of the road operation here in the metropolitan area. During that discussion, I came up with a brilliant idea. Yes, it was my idea, and yes, I overstepped my bounds by writing the amendment, and guess what? I did not do it correctly. So what happened was we had explained the bill on the House floor and also on the Senate floor, and we explained a provision in the bill that was not exactly how it was written. What Article 2 does is it goes back, and it's an attempt to actually, and we had the attorneys do it this time, to actually write into law what we discussed on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate. Now, members, basically what this does, and I can either let Senator Dibble or Ms. Berezovsky, you know, maybe speak to is kind of how I wrote that for those folks that were trying to put amendments together over in the House and what this actually does. What we did was, knowing that the metropolitan counties were taking less and they have some of the highest needs any place in the state, we were trying to take two pots of money, and we're just talking about a small amount of money. This is a couple million dollars to sprinkle over places like Anoka County, Washington County, Dakota County, some of those ring counties. Some of the, you know, the seven-county metropolitan area has a lot of county road needs. And we wanted to take a little bit of that money and plug it in the seven-county metropolitan area, knowing that they lost a full quarter cent, which is $114 million of road money, and they lost their ability to expand their wheelage tax, which was in the original bill. If you add both of those numbers together, it comes out to about roughly $130 million that they actually are not, they were not going to see an increase in road money. They actually need to meet their demand about $40 million. What we try to do, or I'm sorry, about $400 million. What we try to do in this bill, in this provision, is to make sure that we take a couple small chunks of money from two different places and plug it into that formula so that counties like Dakota County and Washington County and Anoka County get a little bit more road money. That's what they signed up for. That was the amendment that I wrote, and that was what we had intended to do. So, members, I think Ms. Boyd has passed out a run. Okay, we'll pass out the runs, because bottom line is, what does this do to the money? And if you look at the back page, I'm sorry, if you look at the bottom of the front page, if you look at the bottom of the, well, the top of the front page is actually the revenues that are going to be gained by Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington counties. It also shows that a portion of this money comes out of leasing, sales tax, revenue, and the flexible highway account, that 5% account that we always talk about. And Ms. Boyd, if you... Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Boyd says that, you know, we need to make one little oral amendment here. So page 66, line 3, I would strike 75 and reinsert the stricken 50 so that it was 50% of the excess sum instead of 75.
Shall we? Should we adopt your amendment? Yeah. Senator Murphy offers the A1 amendment to Senate File 3223.
With the oral amendment.
The oral amendment also. Mm-hmm.
Yes, as amended.
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Same sign.
Great. Thank you.
A1 is amended, is adopted.
Now, Mr. Chairman, does anybody really want any more explanation as to what this does? The runs are out here. And as we can see, there's the first year, if we take the wheelage tax portion out of our bill, which we did, that's about $10 million for the seven-county metropolitan area. So we tried to backfill that, and we do that. And if you look at the totals on the front page, the first year in 2010, they get $10 million, and we built it in such a way so that it grows over a period of time. And after about 10 years, it's up to about $17 million. And that's exactly what it does.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Murphy, no questions.
Great. Mr. Chairman, I know that there's people that want to give testimony on portions of this.
Senator Saltzman has a question.
Yes, I do have an A3 amendment of Senator Murphy. Would you like me to introduce that at some point?
Sure. Let's get all the amendments out on the table.
I have the A3 amendment.
Senator Saltzman. Senator Saltzman removes the A3 amendment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. While that's being passed out, I will start talking about that amendment, Mr. Chair. We heard testimony on a bill that I introduced regarding the deputy commissioner being a chief engineer, and during our testimony in wanting to work with the department, we changed that original bill, and this amendment would go back to the original bill as it was introduced, and that would be that there is a deputy commissioner chief engineer who must be licensed as a professional engineer under Minnesota statute. Then the commissioner may establish three positions in unclassified service at the assistant commissioner, assistant to commissioner, or personal secretary levels, and then we strike the language, no more than two of these positions shall be a deputy commissioner level. That it really resorts back to the fact that my intent was to have one deputy commissioner and that person be the chief engineer for the department.
Mm-hmm. Any questions on the A3 amendment? Senator Saltzman offers the A3 amendment to Senate File 3223 as amended. Does anyone want to testify on for or against this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that amendment would be opposed by the department.
Does anyone wish to testify?
No. Mr. Chairman, I can. I don't think the department likes this amendment, but the author does.
Mr. Chair, if I might know,
Senator Saltzman,
that there is just one deputy commissioner currently at the department, and prior to 2007, there was one deputy commissioner, and that person did serve as the chief engineer. I think we heard testimony that for 20 years that was the arrangement.
Mr. Chairman, this is a friendly Senator amendment Murphy. To me. I think the department... they have some heartburn, but it is I like this amendment.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saltzman, I guess it occurred to me that we had some compromise language that everybody was comfortable with, and I'm trying to find out what's driving this change.
Senator Saltzman.
Since that amendment... was put on, Senator, I was contacted by a number of people that this really diluted the intent of this original bill, and that was that there should be one person in the deputy commissioner position that is highly qualified as an engineer. It does not limit the appointment of an assistant to the commissioner or assistant commissioners, but very clearly when you have two deputy commissioners, you're sort of diluting the intent of this bill. And that's that there is one person in that, you know, particular position at on that level who has technical experience. And I think given the concerns of the public about the management of MnDOT and the level of competency and not having someone within that level of the department that has engineering experience is very disturbing. And this is a reaction to that, and it's sending a message that we need to make sure that people are at the table who are in administration, who are advising the commissioner, who are helping to manage the department, who have the technical experience that I expect they should have. And that's the intent of this. It is not directed at any particular person who is serving in these positions now, but it's something that I think is very important.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dunbar, I'm sure that we're going to have more discussion on this issue. Ms. Parker had just whispered in my ear that, you know, maybe we have a way of accomplishing both. And I'm going to work with Ms. Parker to make sure that, you know, whatever we do here, that they're going to be able to comply.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Saltzman offers the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same aye. Sign. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A5 amendment, and this is the, while it's being passed out, members, this is the bill we heard about the Dan Patch commuter rail line. We put a prohibition on that some years back. This basically removes the prohibition. It's just to allow all the transit authorities the ability to continue to plan. And it's non-controversial, and I don't see a problem with it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Murphy. I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to oppose it. I was part of the effort to put that in law. I'm going to vote against it, but it's probably largely not controversial. It's going to be controversial in one part of the metro, and it's important for the record to reflect that. And so I recall. I think going back, it was Representative Segrin and Senator Belanger's proposal at the time, and so I'm going to stay true to that effort that I can't even remember what year it was, but it's some time ago, but it's a good discussion for the committee to have, but I just wanted to make sure that the record reflected that there's not universal agreement on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Larson, you're correct. I think that, I voted for this prohibition. But I think now that we do have some money to build transit lines, that we need to have the ability to plan everything.
And Mr. Chair and
Senator Larson,
Senator Murphy, I want to be real clear. I have mixed emotions about it, so I'm not. Because I think it's the nature of actually removing something from. Consideration isn't always the best policy.
Right.
We should consider things, and then if they're not feasible or not desired, then. But in this case, there's been a lot of emotion to this issue over time, and so I just wanted to. I'd rather say that before I vote no than to, so you know why, than to.
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate
than to,
that.
Just do that.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it hasn't been noted yet, it should be noted. This is kind of a half step. It does keep in place the prohibition on preliminary engineering, final design, or construction for the dam patch line. And so, if the local communities' hesitancy about the dam patch line really has merit, which it may. I mean, I think there are some real livability issues that were a part of the debate and the discussion. The study and planning phase should really pull it out, and we should we'll have that information, and we can evaluate that. And then there'll be another statutory step to take if it turns out the dam patch line is the best idea we ever came across, and we'll have to remove those prohibitions on engineering, design, and construction.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too want to speak about this. This particular rail line cuts through the heart of my district, and will affect a lot of residents, and I think that's the reason why it was put in place in the first place, the prohibition on the studying of this, and especially north of the river in Bloomington, where we have folks that are literally in their backyard, this rail line. And there are a lot of lines down there that we could probably, we'll start to look at coming out of Northfield. And this particular one, I think, for good reason, was considered and then decided not to be looked at. So I'm not in favor of this at this point.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Can I make
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see Senator Dibble is coming back to the table. And I just want to I can't recall if we were in the House together when this debate occurred.
Yes,
so
we were.
It was the 2001-2002 timeframe that we had this discussion. But, where we may finally end up on this discussion is an area where Senator Dibble and I have a fair amount of experience, and that is how do we mitigate the impact to people when government makes a significant change. We deal with that and have dealt with that in our entire careers as it relates to the airport. We may have some of the very same things as it relates to our ability now to have rail transit in the metropolitan area. And so nonetheless, I think that's going to be an important discussion wherever we develop commuter rail lines that impact communities the way they do. And obviously, this is an exciting time for us, but it also is going to create some challenges, and this is one of those challenges. Mm-hmm. So, I can count votes, and I kind of see, and I think Senator Dahl and I probably won't be successful in how we vote, but I wanted to make sure my concern was noted as well.
Boy, Mr. Chairman, I just wish Senator Day was here so he could see that I was offering up an amendment that even my own members don't appreciate. This is a bipartisan thing here. Everybody hates it equally.
And Senator Murphy, it is in the record.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dahl.
And Senator Murphy and Senator Dibble as well. I not that I'm against commuter rail. Mm-hmm. That's not at all the issue here.
So. Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I understand that. And, when we talk about these commuter rail lines, we're talking about corridors. So it might not just be that little corridor where the old train track used to be. They might decide, okay, maybe that corridor should be over a quarter of a mile or whatever. And, but we just need to have the ability to plan. If this turns out to be, too much, I'm sure the Met Council and all those folks are going to give it the thumbs down and it goes away. But I think that in this day and age with having $114 million on the table, we need to be able to look at what's out there. I renew my A5 motion.
Senator Murphy, renews the A5 amendment motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Wow, those no's were pretty loud. Mr. Chairman, I've got the A7 amendment. And members, while this is being passed out, this is a bill, and this is my mistake, but this is a Senator Metzen bill that passed the full Senate in 07. And it deals with the Lafayette Bridge, and it just says that, this is more of those planning things. If we're going to, when we replace the Lafayette Bridge, it asks that the department look at the reconstruction and the improvement of this bridge and whether or not it's compatible with the possibility of some sort of future transit line, whether it's light rail or whatever. Bus, whatever. This is nothing different. We passed this in 07, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any comment from the department? Ms. Parker.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I believe this amendment was also discussed last year, and the department was very uncomfortable with it. I believe it is not consistent with the planning that the Metropolitan Council is doing for transit lines, and we also, if I'd known it was coming up, I would have brought the file with me. We did an estimate of what the additional cost would be, and I believe it was substantial in the tens of millions of dollars because of the nature of the Lafayette Bridge and the way it ties into the bluffs. I guess I'll have to get back to you with more information, but there are serious concerns both about whether it fits in with the transit plan in the metro area and the additional cost.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Parker is correct in saying that MnDOT had a little issue with this as well last year. I think that there's two words that we can change in there, and I'll work with Ms. Parker, and that's going to allow them to do the planning and take a look at it and give it a thumbs up or thumbs down.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Parker, is this a matter of timing of the study also?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I think that, I think that we just let a contract with someone for the preliminary engineering on that bridge, and I'm not sure what other additional kind of work would need to be done. There would be additional study needed for the light rail issue, and a part of the issue about the cost is the sheer length of the bridge. It's much longer than the 35W bridge. And there were just serious concerns about both the engineering aspects and also, I shouldn't speak for Met Council, but it seems to me that there were discussions about whether there were other routes already being planned for sending, is that say light rail or commuter rail?
Well, Ms. Parker, if I remember
rail
correctly, our conversation was we weren't sure of what the output was of the Robert Street study. And so that we weren't sure what was going to be required on the Lafayette Bridge because of that. That information was not known at the time when you had to let design
on
contracts.
Right.
Is that
Senator Mr. Burton. Chairman, I got a real quick oral amendment here, and I think if we put this on, that MnDOT will be perfectly comfortable, and Senator Metzen will still meet his objective. At the end, before the period, on line 7, just insert "and is consistent with the Metropolitan Council's transit plan."
It's a good try. I'll have to talk to Mr. Shetland, I believe.
Maybe Amy or transit.
Can you restate that amendment again?
"And is consistent with the Metropolitan Council transit plan."
Ms. Berezovsky, maybe
the 2020 plan or whatever their newest version is.
Read back. Ms. Berezovsky can read back the amendment. I'm sorry, Senator Dibble.
Just a little language change. Perhaps it should read the Met Council, Metropolitan Council, the transit portion of the Metropolitan Council's transportation plan.
Okay.
Transit portion of the Metropolitan Council's transportation plan.
Okay.
Could you read back the amendment, Ms. Berezovsky?
Mr. Chair, on line 1.7, before the period, insert "and is consistent with the transit portion of the Metropolitan Council transportation plan."
Thank you.
I'd renew my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy moves the A7 amendment as amended. Any questions? Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Mr. Chairman,
amendment is adopted.
The next amendment I have, this goes to the towing issue, is to, and I'm going to offer the A4 amendment, but this deletes the provisions in the underlying bill in regards to impounded vehicles and the retrieval of its contents. I'm going to offer this up. Senator Dibble has someone here to speak on the issue, and I believe there's folks here from the towing folks as well, and I should probably let Senator Dibble go first.
Senator Dibble. Senator Murphy, you are offering the A4 amendment.
I'm offering the A4 amendment, which removes Senator Dibble's impounded vehicles from the bill. And I think Mr. Elwood is here to speak in opposition. Yeah, if you guys want to take over, that's fine.
Senator Dibble, and speed is getting important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, what the original language of Senate File 3223 does is provides a fairly reasonable and modest way for folks who are in very, very difficult circumstances to retrieve contents from their vehicles that are very crucial to them and in their life and their in many cases their livelihood or their kids. It's a proposal that's been in front of the committee a couple of times before, and it's been scaled back fairly significantly. We've attempted to respond to some of the criticisms, even though it's been very difficult because it's been hard to have productive conversations. But you know, we've managed to intuit what some of the major objections were to some of the previous proposals. So what we try to do is provide a fairly reasonable way for folks, particularly very, very low-income people, to be able to retrieve the contents of their vehicles that are, you know, very, very crucial in nature: medicine, you know, school books, legal documents, et cetera. There's a handout. I don't know if it's made it around. Article in the paper yesterday that Nick Coleman wrote that talks about exactly what we're trying, you know, who we're trying to do this on behalf of and why. You know, a number of folks who are extremely low income, you know, make mistakes occasionally and they have their cars towed, as many of us have experienced. I have experienced in the past. You know, it's a pretty big hit to my monthly budget. You know, a lot of folks just, they're just not going to be able to retrieve their car. If someone's not able to retrieve their car, you know, they're giving up a huge asset because they can't pay parking ticket, the tow, the cost of the tow, and then, you know, these daily storage fees start to compound very, very quickly, and people just can't retrieve their cars. So they're out the car, they're potentially out all the money that they're charged for the tow. And then they've also, you know, lost their, you know, all these, their kids' books, medicine, medical equipment, you name it. What we try to do in the bill is, you know, make sure we're talking specifically about very, very low-income people. That was, you know, an addition and a way of evaluating who is a very low-income person. And we name a very specific set of items that folks can retrieve in most instances: the medicine, the legal documents, et cetera. Make sure that people aren't just wandering willy-nilly into these yards. Make sure that there's a reasonable procedure set forth so that there's not a safety concern or people are just, you know, going back there. And, you know, we also make sure people aren't going in and taking, like, stereos out of the cars, you know, parts of the car, that sort of thing. That was a criticism for. We're really trying to be very, very narrow and very specific in what we're achieving to do. We're also, you know, trying to allow, you know, for all parties to benefit from the proposal, allowing for an expedited process for folks to give up their car. So a lot operator isn't forced to hold on to a car for a certain amount of time. We can shorten that up. Someone can just say, I'm not going to be able to pay for the retrieval of the car. You can have the car and dispose of it, do what you do, realize some value from the actual car itself. Allow cities have long asked for what's called a deficiency judgment or deficiency claim, you know, so that they can seek to be made whole from folks who have taken too long or haven't retrieved their car, that we do exempt very low-income people from that provision. I think that's the high-level overview. I'll let Mr. Elwood, who's been working on this as well for a number of years, fill in my gaps and provide some testimony.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. Senator Dibble pretty much said it. I just want to emphasize where we've come, I think we've really tried to, we have listened, we have heard, and we have responded to the concerns that we've heard from the industry over the years. The bottom line here is, if you're poor or homeless and you can prove it, then you are able to obtain your personal belongings, because otherwise they simply just get destroyed and these folks never see their things again. The coalition, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and Catholic Charities are also supporting this bill. Folks were here from both of those agencies. They had to leave, but I have been authorized to say that they certainly are supportive of the bill. I could tell you stories from all over the state, but I will only say this in the interest of time. The Coalition for the Homeless folks told me that they were absolutely surprised at the vast number of people that this issue affected, and Catholic Charities has mentioned a similar surprise at the widespread nature of the clients that they see. And I'd be happy to answer questions on any of the specifics of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saltzman.
Where is this language at in the bill after this, you know, after all these sections are deleted? I'm missing something.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saltzman, starts at page 14, section 20.
Yeah, or otherwise, Mr. Chair, the bill, the original bill is somewhere in your packet before the delete all. So if you don't want to have to rifle through the larger delete all bill, this discrete version, because the delete all is the vehicle.
Right.
I mean, this is the vehicle for the delete all bill. So
okay.
So the actual original language of the bill, which is my bill, is in front of you if you can't find it. So somewhere in your stack of paper.
Senator Dibble, and the bill number is
3223.
Senate file. Your original. That's right.
Okay. Yeah, Senate
file
3223, the original 3223 before the A1 amendment. Also, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I thought I'd also mention that we, in Section 7, also attempt to allow the industry to benefit from this bill, allowing tow trucks to be overweight when they're towing. That's something they've sought for a while. Subject to a fee, a permit.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in support of the amendment? Anyone else in opposition to the amendment? Senator, yes, sir. We have a person here who wants to speak in opposition.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Seward is here from Seward Garage and Towing, I believe, isn't
yes.
it? Okay.
This is a supporter. Mr.
Is a supporter of the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment. Please state your name. Spell it for me, too, please.
Todd Seward, T-O-D-D, S as in Sam, I-E-W-E-R-T.
Again, please.
Seward. S as in Sam, I-E-W-E-R-T.
E-R-T, okay. Mr. Seward.
I'm here to testify on behalf of not only myself, but the Minnesota Professional Towing Association. We oppose the legislation that's been set forward. First, I'd like to discuss the weight measure that has been discussed and has been attached to this bill for the last couple of years. The bill really has nothing to do with the contents bill, and it's a very important bill. The Towing Association and its members went to MnDOT several years ago. We have a problem with removing oversized and overweight vehicles from the roadway. They're already at the maximum when they break down, and then we go out and tow them, and we have massive equipment to be able to do that, but we have a weight problem. So we addressed the situation with MnDOT, and the towers did not come up with a solution. MnDOT came up with a solution. To be able to allow safe removal of these vehicles from roadways, whether they're in an accident, which there already is an exemption, but when they're also broken down. So I believe that that should be stand on its own, and it's a very important public safety issue that would get taken care of. As far as the content bill, portion of the bill. We empathize with the poor people. We've worked several years trying to find a solution to this seemingly simple problem, but I believe when you deal with homeless people, it's never simple. We've worked with several agencies up here. We've been through all this before. We've testified several times up here in the Senate and the House. We've tried to work with Ron Elwood. He's turned a deaf ear this year. I never returned my phone calls. Looking at the bill on the outset, it looks like a great idea. Everybody gets what they want. Homeless people get taken care of. People get their contents. The tours have been considered. Everything looks rosy. But when you look at it objectively, there's 27 or 28 steps that a tour is going to have to go through to release these vehicles. We didn't create the poor people and the homeless people. We didn't create the situation where the cars got towed. We just happened to tow them, and we're on the end of the food chain, and we're responsible for it, kind of like a police officer making an arrest. He's not very popular at that end either. The difference with the police officer, he has protection to shield them from these types of things. We're out standing by ourselves trying to take care of these things properly. In that process, we do try to get paid, obviously, for the things that we do. The problem with the bill is it's just so vague. It says that these unlimited things that are required by TORS. What I see is it's just going to be a burden on the TORS, and it's going to open us up to more liability. We'll be in court more. I mean, it works good for Ron Elwood. He's in the legal business. It opens him up for more litigation, but it doesn't solve the problem. We need to continue to work on that end of the problem and find a viable solution. We've made several recommendations. One of them is not very popular, is maybe the tow should get paid by the state. The state is ordering tows. We don't expect that. We don't want anything in that order. A good viable solution to work through social services and those types of things that people are trained professionals that are in that area that can deal with it on a proper level basis. That's the avenue that we've been trying to work through, and that's where we stand with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seward.
And Mr. Chairman, I think what Mr.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you. I think what Mr. Seward said at the very end is very important to take into consideration, because Senator Dibble and Mr. Elwood are asking the towers to be able to delineate between poor people and people who have ability to pay. I think that if we continue to move forward with these discussions, that there needs to be a way that the tower can feel comfortable knowing that this person is someone who has no resources. And in that case, I think the people that make that judgment are social services. And why can't we have something in place that says that you can go to social services and be declared of being, you know, poor, and then take that piece of paper to the tour and say, okay, you know, here's our verification. What we're asking right now is we're asking the tour to verify that they're poor. And that's, you know, you're placing the burden in the wrong spot. And I think the other thing that Mr. Seward said that was very important is that a couple of years ago we had a fix with this, and it was where the state was going to reparate the tour for making these tolls. Because in the metropolitan area, more than in greater Minnesota, there's more of this type of activity. And it's more of a financial burden than it is maybe in Rentwang or Kenyon or Wanamingo. But we weren't successful in gaining the money that it was going to take to put that in place.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I feel frustrated. I have to articulate that. 3 points. One is Mr. Elwood has made numerous, numerous good faith attempts to negotiate throughout this year with the industry, and they have declined to have a productive conversation. Nevertheless, we have been able to make some key changes in this bill, and it would help if the industry had actually read the bill before we came. Criticism was in the past bill that there was a private right of action. There is no private right of action. No one's going to be suing anyone. Mr. Elwood's not going to be suing anyone. That was removed from the bill. We did put in provisions so that responding to another criticism, to Senator Murphy's point, social services, people do have to prove if they're low income or not. So we're not asking the towers to sit in judgment. We're addressing that very point specifically. Mr. Elwood wanted to respond as well to the criticism that he hadn't been responsive to the industry.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members, I just think it's important for me to put on the record the facts of this and to refute the assertion that I did not respond to the industry. The facts of how this came down this year was I sent the bill to the association. I had a phone call with the witness, and I had offered to continue discussions, and if he was interested in having further discussions, of course we'd be willing to continue talking. We've been talking for several years, and I offered to have him call me at any time. I did not receive a phone call for several months on this issue at all from anybody, from the association or anybody in opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
I'd like to, on the A4 amendment, I'd like to strike one line 1.7. That relates to the length of the tow vehicles that they were talking about.
Senator Olsen, you're looking at, if this amendment is adopted, then Section 51 stays.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Could I make one more statement, please?
Sure, Mr. Seward.
Thank you. The other thing that the bill states is it's not only a homeless bill here, it also goes back to the point where we're going to give all these personal belongings to people that can pay. I apologize, I do not have a Senate or copy, I only have a House copy, which I believe is very close to the same. But it does have a provision in there that allows us or requires us to release a number of items, which most TORs do anyway, but now when it's in law, Mr. Elwood states that they took the litigation thing out about the criminal behavior that it was in last year. No, I believe that a law, part of the reason we have a law here is if we break the laws, there's going to be litigation. So I don't believe that protects the TOR at all. So those two comments, I appreciate your time.
Mr. Chair?
We're going to have to vote. Mr. Elwood, real brief.
Well, just quickly, Mr. Chair and members, I think that's the exact opposite of what this bill does. In fact, it does separate the can't pays from the won't pays. The list is very clear about who is eligible, and it is tied to our current provisions regarding the definitions of poverty in Minnesota. So it's a bright line between who can pay and who can't pay. I just want to make that absolutely crystal clear. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Murphy, do you want to incorporate Senator Olsen's amendment into your amendment?
Yes.
All right, so that's incorporated into the A4 amendment. Senator Murphy moves.
To be clear, what is the Olsen amendment?
The Olsen amendment is to delete line 1.7 on the A4 amendment. So if that amendment were adopted, then the tow truck extra lengths would be left in.
Mr. Chair?
Would not be left.
Would not be.
Oh, would be left. So that's the only thing that would survive in the bill.
Yes. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, as compelling as I find the testimony from our business individual who is here to testify for the A4 amendment, I must say that I think that I've had a chance to look at the language of the bill and the provisions that are in the that are currently in the bill are part of an effort that has been before us a number of years in a row. And I'm going to not support the A4 amendment because I think that there is sufficient work that has been done to really to restrict it very narrowly to the people who can't afford to get their vehicles but need access to very critical items in their vehicles. Maybe they have medications or things that they need to get out of the vehicle. So for those people who have those kind of dire needs and need to have access to the content, I'm going to respectfully oppose Senator Murphy's A4 amendment, and I ask for support from members of this committee.
Senator Murphy moves.
Sorry.
And to be clear, I'm agnostic on the Olsen amendment, but when we get to the larger amendment, I'm opposed to the larger amendment.
Thank you, Senator Devil. Senator renews his motion for the A4 amendment as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign?
No.
No. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, well, I know we're running out of time here, but I do have...
We have a division call for. All those in favor of the A4 amendment, raise your hand.
No, it's Olsen.
Because the Olsen amendment.
To adopt the A4 amendment, which removes the towing language, original towing language. All those opposed to the A4 amendment.
You got pretty good ears, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair, I do have the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Salt.
Were we voting on the Olsen? Wasn't there an Olsen amendment?
There was an Olsen amendment, correct.
Did we
No, we did not vote on it because it was adopted as a friendly amendment to the A4 amendment. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Murphy, I know briefly talked about this, but I needed to have just at least a two-minute discussion on this. There's something that's come to my attention in regards to the UPA especially. And when we get to the south end of the UPA line, the park and rides that are down there that we're trying to get service to, there's some question about whether or not we're going to be able to Met Council's been able to work with those lines or those areas, if those areas that they exist in, namely Lakeville and Farmington, are not part of the transit taxing district. And the A6 amendment is extends the taxing district to Farmington and Lakeville, and attempt to be able to allow that service to do. And I'd like if we could maybe in regards to this amendment have someone from Met Council speak just for a couple of minutes on that issue.
Sure, we've got a couple of minutes. Is there somebody here from the Met Council?
Senator Murphy is bringing someone to testify for the Met Council. And please state your name. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Amy Venowitz with the Metropolitan Council. This amendment actually has two pieces to it. The first piece, and I don't have a copy of the amendment in front of me, but the language is a clarification of the current replacement service language, which is also known as the opt-out language, to clarify that an opt-out provider does have authority to provide service outside of the existing Metropolitan Transit Taxing District. I think the council, our assumption had already been similar to that, so this, in our mind, is just clarifying language, and we have no issue with the first section. The second section is amending the current transit taxing district to add Farmington and Lakeville, and that section is not supported by the council and the governor. We have been in discussions with the city of Lakeville and are in the process of trying to come up with a negotiation where they would agree to come into the transit taxing district, which is allowed under current law. And so that is taking place now. Our intent is that for the Cedar Avenue BRT and also the I-35W BRT, both are planned to extend into the city of Lakeville, but we would not make that extension until Lakeville has actually joined the transit taxing district. So we think we can accomplish it with the city of Lakeville without this language, and the governor in particular is opposed to the language.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Senator Dole brings up a good point. This is about fairness. The folks down in that neck of the woods are using transit services that are paid by everybody else in the taxing district, and the expansion to Lakeville is a common sense approach. And I know that Ms. Vinowitz speaks on behalf of the governor, but this was also the governor that you know doesn't believe that transportation is very high on the list to begin with. So I think that in fairness we need to expand that district to include the Lakeville area, because those park and rides down there are full. And you know, if you're gonna play, let's pay. That's what this is all about. So I support the amendment.
Ms. Vinowitz, can you explain to me, now you said that there was some discussions with Farmington and Lakeville, and what's the schedule of getting a decision here?
Mr. Chair, no discussions have taken place with the city of Farmington, and neither the Cedar Avenue or 35W BRT extend into the city of Farmington. So it's only the city of Lakeville, and we have had ongoing discussions with them. I don't know that there's a set timeline for ending the discussion. It current law allows communities to come into the transit taxing district once they come to an agreement with the Metropolitan Council. So they're, at this point, we're not operating under a set timeline.
From what I understand, the facilities are already being planned for improvement in Lakeville. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Both the Cedar Avenue BRT and the 35W have a plan to include a park and ride in the city of Lakeville. But those facilities and service to those facilities would not move forward until the city of Lakeville has joined the transit taxing district.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I just simply want to renew my motion to move the A6 amendment.
Senator Dahl moves the A6 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I want to briefly say that members, in this bill is the primary seatbelt bill. This is something that a very important person of our family had worked on the vast majority of her adult life, and that was Catherine Swanson, who lost her battle with ALS a few weeks ago. And we're not coming back from conference committee if this provision is not in the bill, period. As a matter of fact, there will be no further policy done in the transportation committee in either body until this is passed, because it has to pass both bodies. And I think it's time for the Senate to stand up on this issue and basically memorialize this bill for Catherine Swanson. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 3223 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Senator Murphy moves.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, it has to go to Finance. I'm sorry.
Senator Murphy moves Senate File 3223 as amended be recommended to pass and forwarded to Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
Thank
you.
Mr.
It is
Chairman.
Motion approved. And we are adjourned.